Today is February 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Coming up,
we're going to be signing today and registering national emergency. And it's a great thing to do because we have an invasion of drugs, invasion of gangs, invasion of people.
Also ahead, U.S. and Chinese officials continue trade talks in an effort to resolve disputes over tariffs, state subsidies, and intellectual property rights. As European Union elections near, the rise of populist politics could bring major changes to the European lawmaking body. It's all on International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump this morning in Washington said he is declaring a state of emergency along the U.S. southern border with Mexico. This move, he says, will allow him to move funds from other areas to build a border wall after Congress failed to allocate the $5.7 billion he asked for in the budget bill passed yesterday. President Trump has until midnight today to sign the bill, which gives about $1.4 billion for border barriers. The budget bill passed just in time to avoid another partial government shutdown. In December, Congress and the president failed to agree on funding, and about a third of the government shut down for about 5 weeks. The opposition Democrats oppose the emergency declaration, as do some members of Trump's Republican Party. The Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat, has promised to fight the move. To discuss and help explain the issue with us today is VOA Capitol Hill correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, thank you for being with us.
You're so welcome, Mario.
Catherine, the president declared a national emergency today at the White House. What does it mean when the president declares a national emergency?
Well, what it usually means, Mario, is that the president is addressing an imminent threat of some kind, a hurricane, a flood, or even a national emergency was declared after the terrorist attacks of September 11th. Basically, what it means is that the president is accessing funds that are not able to be quickly dispersed by acts of Congress. It's an imminent threat. But of course, in this case, it's very different. We know that the president has been calling for a way of addressing this emergency at the border for a very long time. So it's very different in terms of the immediacy of the threat. And of course, if you talk to congressional Democrats, they would say that there is no emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border, that this is a trumped-up crisis on the part of the president.
Exactly. The opposition Democrats have strongly opposed the use of the power of declaring a national emergency. But what do you expect will be the response from the Democrats in the House and possibly in the courts?
Well, I absolutely, and the president himself, anticipates a legal challenge to this move, something that he said would likely go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in the land. I also know that Nancy Pelosi is considering filing her own challenge. She also has an option at her disposal to call a vote to terminate the president's declaration. And that would be on the grounds that there is no national emergency. Now, that would put lawmakers in a very interesting position. That would likely pass the Democratic-controlled House. Then it would go over to the Republican-majority U.S. Senate, where some Republicans who have expressed some concern about this move would have to choose between rebuking the president publicly or going against something that they feel uncomfortable about. And the reason they feel uncomfortable about that, because they're saying that what's to stop the next president, if they're a Democrat, from declaring a national emergency that then they don't like and taking control of those funds?
Thank you very much, Catherine. That was Catherine Gibson, VOA Capitol Hill correspondent. Another round of talks between U.S. and Chinese trade representatives is set to take place in Washington next week, Chinese media report. Trade experts say that it is a good sign as American and Chinese officials wrap up their meetings in Beijing in an effort to resolve their trade disputes. Negotiators are working to reach a trade agreement before the 1st of March. At that time, U.S. tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods are set to increase from 10% to 25%. Earlier this week, President Donald Trump suggested the deadline could be pushed back if there are signs of progress in negotiations. However, White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said no such decision has been made. Kudlow said talks were going well ahead of the U.S. officials' meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
They're covering all the ground. They're hard at it. They are going to meet with President Xi, so that's a very good sign. And they're just soldiering on. So, you know, I like that story, and I will stay with the phrase, the vibe is good.
Tariffs, China's support for its industries, and intellectual property are among the issues being discussed. Among the top stories in the world, human rights observers and officials with the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces say fighters with the Islamic State terror group are clinging to one last sliver of land in Syria. Nearly the entire Mekong Delta in Vietnam will sink underwater by the year 2100, a new study predicts. And a new UN report documents widespread sexual violence against women and girls in southern Sudan's Northern Unity region. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOA website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Marine Le Pen, head of France's far-right regional rally party, says European populist parties will surge in May's European Parliament elections, a forecast shared by some experts and which may shake up European institutions and politics. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
In an interview with VOA, National Rally leader Marine Le Pen described today's Europe at a turning point, with European Parliament elections marking a potential watershed. Le Pen said she believes Europe is moving toward a return of nation states, and that her National Rally party is part of what she calls a great political movement supporting this direction. She called for turning the European Union into a cooperation among nations rather than a so-called super state. Le Pen lost to President Emmanuel Macron in presidential elections 2 years ago, but today her party is surging in the polls. A public opinion survey this week shows the National Rally Party and Macron's Republic on the Move party are neck and neck for May's EU Parliament vote. Nor is France the only country where populist parties stand to show strong gains in European elections. Today, nationalist parties lead governments in several EU states, including Italy, Poland, and Hungary.
They could potentially go up to or beyond a third of seats in the European Parliament.
Senior policy fellow Susie Dennison of the European Council on Foreign Relations Policy Institute describes what might happen if what she calls anti-Europe parties score well.
Which would give them access to places on committees, the ability to form a political group, which gives them funds and the opportunity to kind of work as a bloc to prevent decisions on some key areas.
She says the parties may gain a say on issues like the European budget and even the appointment of EU commissioners. These views are shared by other experts, but some analysts say predictions of a major populist surge are overblown. In France, the Yellow Vest protest movement adds a complicating factor to the May vote, presenting a potential opportunity or competition for Le Pen's party.
Moi, je ne considère pas du tout les gilets jaunes comme une menace.
Le Pen says she doesn't consider the movement a threat. If yellow vests run for the EU parliament vote, she says she's for it. That's democracy. Polls suggest candidates running under the yellow vest banner could prove a disruptive force in the EU vote, possibly stealing votes from Le Pen's party. But the grassroots movement is divided and leaderless, and many doubt it can transform into a real political force. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Nigeria has closed its borders as part of security measures ahead of tomorrow's presidential election. President Muhammadu Buhari faces a challenge from Atiku Abubakar. However, security concerns are high over possible violence. Vote counting will start as soon as polls close at 6 p.m. local time tomorrow. Results of the vote are expected by late Sunday or Monday. VOA staffer Peter Cloti is in Nigeria. He reported that the mood is mixed in the country, but there are concerns about violence and other issues. Nigeria's top two candidates in the election are not new to politics, nor for that matter running for president in Africa's most populous nation. But the race between President Buhari and challenger Atiku Abubakar is not just close in terms of who could win, but also in the main campaign issues. VOA's Anita Powell reports in depth on the election from Johannesburg.
Two political heavyweights, both former leaders in their 70s, are vying for the top office in Nigeria. 76-year-old incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari swept to power in 2015 on promises to improve Nigeria's security, oil-dependent economy, and reputation for rampant corruption. His opponent, 72-year-old former vice president and businessman Atiku Abubakar, is campaigning on a similar platform. Analyst Julian Parker has been studying Nigeria for a decade and says this year's poll, with its striking similarities to previous polls, might provoke apathy among voters.
These two frontrunners in the election race have been in politics for decades. This is not their first time either for running for president. Between them, they've nearly run for the presidency 10 times.
Both men have stressed the need for greater security, particularly in the fight against Islamist militants in the north, and for economic diversity, away from Nigeria's dependence on oil. While their words on the other crucial issue, corruption, are similar, their reputations differ. Buhari made clean governance his signature issue and is widely described in Nigeria as incorruptible. But in an interview with VOA, he agreed with critics that corruption has not been wiped out.
Yes, there will always be people who will be prepared to offer bribes. But what we feel is just like the military operation. Whoever is caught accepting bribe, will certainly be dealt with.
But Abubakar, known as Atiku to his followers, is dogged by corruption allegations, which he quickly denied in an interview with VOA. He said he plans to take a hardline approach on corruption as well.
You just have to strengthen your laws and also strengthen your processes to make sure that people don't escape, and also make sure that people who are accused of corruption, are tried in a very, very fast manner, so that you don't allow... I certainly will not agree or allow a situation where corrupt trials last for several years.
While some analysts predict a tight presidential race, it could come down to demographics and identity politics. But Parker says voters should also look at Buhari's health problems. He spent several months of his first term living abroad and receiving treatment for an unspecified illness.
Buhari's health is a huge factor. It's a huge source of concern for a lot of people, investing in Nigeria in terms of, is he going to be able to complete his term? What does that mean for the political stability?
She notes that Buhari is backed by a popular deputy, Oluyemi Osinbajo.
We know that Buhari will, if he has to, will hand over to his deputy. And his deputy is actually a very dynamic, business-friendly, young guy who's got quite a lot of national appeal. He's been able to broker peace in the rest of Niger Delta region.
In December, Buhari denied rumors he had died and been replaced by a body double. As for his health, he said, he is going strong. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization says that measles outbreaks and deaths are surging globally, putting years of progress made in reducing the killer disease at risk. The WHO is calling for urgent action to stop the spread of the highly contagious disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Measles is a fully preventable disease. The World Health Organization says a safe, effective vaccine, which has been around for 50 years, has protected billions of children. But WHO Director of Immunization, Vaccines and Biologicals, Catherine O'Brien, says progress is at risk because of the failure to vaccinate many children in all regions of the world.
Measles as a virus is one of the most contagious infections that there is. For every case of measles that occurs in a setting where people are not immune, 9 to 10 additional cases will occur simply because of exposure to that case.
O'Brien notes measles is spread by respiratory droplets that can live on surfaces for hours. Therefore, it is not necessary to have direct contact with an infected person to get sick. The WHO says 229,000 cases of measles were reported worldwide last year, but it says the number of reported cases represents less than 10% of actual cases, so millions of cases are occurring. Africa is one of the regional hotspots. Katrina Kertzinger, a WHO medical officer in the expanded program on immunization, says there have been measles outbreaks of varying magnitude in all countries in this region.
Madagascar is currently experiencing an outbreak from the period from 2018 to present. There's over 66,000 cases that have been reported in that country alone. I personally was in Madagascar several weeks ago, and I could say as a clinician how heartbreaking it is to be in a context where there's measles cases which are entirely preventable.
The WHO says many children in poor countries are not being vaccinated because they live in marginalized areas where clinics are not easily reached. In wealthier countries, it says parents sometimes choose not to have their children immunized because of false claims that the vaccine is dangerous. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, why do U.S. intelligence chiefs and U.S. President Donald Trump differ on threats emanating from North Korea, Iran, Russia, and the so-called Islamic State? What foreign policy issues did Mr. Trump highlight in his annual State of the Union address? We'll talk about the politics and substance of U.S. national security next on Encounter, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
After the February 17th revolution that eventually ended four decades of dictatorship, Libya remains divided and in a near-failed state situation. The United Nations mission in Libya is planning a national conference to pave the way for a new constitution and elections. Wolfgang Pastai is chairman of the advisory board of the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about the chaos in Libya and the prospects for reaching a political solution.
Well, I would say there are several root causes for the current situation. The most important ones are the century-old tribal conflicts in several parts of the country, in particular in the east and in the south, the heritage of the chaotic administration of the Gaddafi regime, the influence of radical Islam, and the increasing rift between the east and the west. One needs to be aware that until 1911, Libya was at most times not a unified country. Libya, as we know it right now, exists only since 1911. Another very important factor from my point of view is the stubborn adherence of the international community to the failed Libya political agreement and its virtually non-existent government of national accord. This GNA doesn't even have its capital under control, let alone the rest of the country. It's actually on the mercy of the local militias. This is frequently blamed by the international community on the Eastern strongman Marshal Haftar, but he has next to nil influence in Tripoli. So he is responsible for many things going on in Libya, but certainly not for the chaos in Tripoli.
The UN mission in Libya is planning a Libyan national conference to pave the way for a new constitution and elections. What would make or break such a plan?
From my point of view, it's decisive to have the right composition of the participants. This was one of the major problems with Shkira's peace negotiations in Morocco, led by the United Nations. It is necessary to select the right people. This means I would strongly recommend to take the elected local representatives. There were local elections almost all over Libya, and the people who were elected there, those are really democratically elected representatives of the local communities, and they should represent their entities in this national conference. But it's also about the ends of this conference. If it is just to rubber stamp the plan for elections and the roadmap for the constitution, which is a very problematic draft, it will be certainly a failure. But the conference could also become a success if it is used to change the direction of the stabilization process. I would say a decentralized bottom-up approach based on the 10 governorates or on the 3 historic provinces could Libya lead to a better future.
So how crucial is stabilizing Libya before going through reconciliation and unification of the war-torn country?
It is absolutely not realistic to achieve reconciliation in the near future, no doubt about it. But the country can be kept together for the time being through the 3 major economic institutions, the National Oil Corporation, the Central Bank of Libya, and the Libyan Investment Authority. But this won't work forever. So it is necessary to use these economic entities based on a proper political foundation to stabilize the country right now. And in the midterm, the Libyans can decide about their own future.
So what are the prospects for reaching a political solution in Libya after all what Libya went through?
As long as the United Nations insists on the current Libyan agreement approach with this top-down and immediate elections, the prospects are extremely dire. But as I've indicated before, there is a chance if there is a change of the direction of the peace process. Based on the achievements of the Libya political agreement right now, it would be necessary to use this national conference to change the direction. To use best suited would be the former Libyan constitution from 1963, amended with some other elements, as a foundation for the stabilization of the country in a decentralized way. It's simply not realistic to find any politician, anyone in Libya, who will be accepted all over the country. The hatred between the East, many people in the East, and many people in the West, is simply too deep.
That was Wolfgang Pastai with the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations. He was speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shanawi. You have been listening to International Edition. You can find us on voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and engineer, Nick Ivanov. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr. in Washington. Be sure to enjoy your day.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.